My name is Nell Freudenberger, and my novel is called The Limits.
Nell Freudenberger's new novel, The Limits, is a heavily researched, heavily nuanced work of fiction that explores marine biology, nuclear testing, family dynamics, and motherhood, all within the confines of the COVID pandemic. It dives into the struggles people have to reach each other across the boundaries of nation, race, and class. From KMEW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Nell Freudenberger. So can you give our listeners a description of the book?
Sure. The book takes place on several islands, the island of Manhattan, Staten Island, Long Island, which is close to home for me, and then an island called Mauréa that's in part of French Polynesia in Oceania. And it's about a scientist who studies the deep ocean, and she has a teenage daughter. And when the book opens, her daughter has gone back to Manhattan to live with her father and go to school there. It happens during 2020. And so the mother and daughter are separated, not only by huge geographic distance, but also by the pandemic. And her daughter Pia, when she arrives in Manhattan, is meeting her new stepmother for the first time. And her stepmother is expecting a baby. And because of the pandemic, they spend much more time together than a stepmother and new stepdaughter probably should.
So tell me about your experience and research on Mauréa and its coral reefs. I mean, what got you interested in this area and what made this the ideal setting for Natalie's storyline?
So Mauréa is an epicenter of coral science. And I knew that Natalie studied coral because, the book is really about the limits that the natural world puts on our kind of most intimate relationships. And she's working at a time where coral is under extreme threat. And I knew that I had to go and see the place where she would work. She's French, and she works at a French national lab that's a real lab called CREOB on Mauréa, which is a small island with a big reach. And there are two research stations there. One is run by Berkeley and one is run by the French government. And I had the opportunity to go twice while I was working on the book. I have to tell you, it's really hard to convince magazine editors that you have to go to Tahiti. No one believes you. and I was really lucky that a wonderful editor named Kevin Berger at Nautilus Magazine, which is a science magazine, but a science magazine that's really for a general audience, was willing to send me there. And it was such an interesting experience for me because I went thinking that I was trying to meet a scientist like the one I was writing about in my novel. And that was part of it. But really, when I got there, I learned so much about the colonial context in French Polynesia and the way that that is still very present. And also about the ways that indigenous scientists on the island have been doing their own type of conservation for centuries, and how Western scientists are just kind of starting to learn about that. So I met incredible people. I went back to Mauréa with my family the next year, and there was a really wonderful British scientist at the French lab who just couldn't have been more generous, taking us around and showing my kids. This blew my mind. She had a virtual fish tank. And so the scientists were able to program things that were happening on the walls of the fish tank and then watch what the real fish inside this fish tank would do. And so she let my kids, propose a scenario. Of course, my son wanted a shark to appear. but just to get to see what the kind of work that they were doing and what it looked like, on a daily basis was totally inspiring for me.
Well, oceanic and coral research wasn't your only exploration. I mean, in your acknowledgments, you mentioned learning about infectious disease and cardiology and nuclear testing, and there's French peppered throughout. How long have you been working on this novel, and how much of your writing process is research?
I think that, so I started writing a novel in 2019 that I threw away at the end of 2020. It was a full first draft. I make a lot of mistakes, but usually not a whole book that gets thrown away. And so although that book had nothing to do with this one, I think that was the way I started. And For me, the research is really, it's like kind of part of the practice of writing. I need to be learning something when I'm writing in order to do the writing, but a lot of what I'm learning doesn't necessarily go into the book. So from my last book, I learned a lot about physics. For this book, I had to learn to dive. I just had to see what the scientist would see if she were under the water. And there was a scientist who described to me in one of our first Zooms what it was like to, and I'm sure divers among your listeners will be familiar with this, but for me, it was completely new. The idea that you would be swimming over a reef and looking at all the amazing things that live there. And then the reef would drop off as it does toward the deeper ocean. And as you swim out over that, you have the feeling that you're going over a cliff. And you actually feel vertigo, even though, of course, there's no way that you could fall. And I thought that was something I really wanted to experience. And there's no way I would, because I had this open water, you know, beginner certification that only let me go down 60 feet. And in fact, on the first practical dive that I went on, which was in Belize, we went out over that, just that type of wall. And I had just the experience that I'd been hoping that the character in the book would have. So that was absolutely thrilling. And I, you know, I found myself, I've always been interested in marine biology, but, you know, the way that kids are, I didn't know much. And I was amazed by sponges. I know this is a strange thing to say, but on the first dive I went on, there were these yellow and purple, huge sponges, maybe 6 feet tall, you know, living on the surface of the reef. And I found myself so moved by them, by how different they were, almost like meeting aliens, you know, for the first time. They were just this life form that was completely, you know, other than what we see on land.
You know, sometimes it feels like the COVID pandemic is a bit like childbirth. You know, whatever hormones are released to help the mother forget the pain of childbirth must be similar to what I've experienced since 2020, because that time seems a bit foggy to me. But your novel served as a grim and important reminder of this time that we shouldn't forget, because it is so easy to forget how awful it was. And it also showed many perspectives from that time, from hospital staff, school teachers, students. How did you feel about writing about COVID and balancing it with this character study?
That is such a good question, and so interesting to compare COVID to childbirth. I've never, even though there's so many young kids and babies, and the book is in a lot of ways about caregiving, I never thought about that analogy. You know, I'm a contemporary novelist. I'm really interested. Like, I feel like writing is my way of thinking, kind of processing what's happening around me. So I write novels that are set in the present. So if I have a novel that's coming out in 2024, it's going to have the pandemic in it. I really didn't set out to write about the pandemic, but the pandemic did sort of give novelists a gift in the sense of, like, when we were in our creative writing program, we always talked about staying in the room with the tension. And as we all remember, we were in the room with the tension much longer than we wanted to be. I work with students, with high school students, and we always work in person. We work on college essays. But during the pandemic, we were suddenly sort of in each other's homes. And one of the things that struck me was that I've always worked with students who have jobs outside of school. And, you know, it's one thing to be on a Zoom with a kid who's making a smoothie at Jamba Juice, or a kid who's really tired because he's been up late delivering cookies for insomnia the night before. I don't know if you guys have insomnia. Cookies, a big thing here. But then, you know, during the pandemic, I met all these girls who were taking care of relatives, you know, young relatives, because the daycare centers were closed. And if your parents are essential workers, of course, it's the teenage girl who's going to be the one who's stuck with the kids. And what I really noticed was these one girl in particular, but many young women who were taking care of children with love and creativity, you know, usually like a nephew or a niece, that I really struggled to find in myself when my children were home day after day. You know, it was very tempting to be, my daughter has this note that she found that I wrote for her that said, please make sure my son gets on Zoom at 1:15 for his anti-bias curriculum. I need to take a nap. You know, and she's just laughing. She's like, this is our document of the pandemic. But I was often farming stuff out to my teenager because I found it hard to manage. So just the idea that teenagers were managing this, I wanted to kind of like honor it in the book.
Well, and I want to talk a little bit about that, because it seemed to me there were different forms of motherhood in the book. Kate is pregnant. She's a stepmother to Pia. Natalie is mothering Pia from afar in Tahiti. Athena seems to be more of a mother to her nephew Marcus than her sister Brianna. And even Francis's mothering style is interesting. As you know, so many of the subjects in your book are heavily researched, like we talked about. How did you research so many approaches to mothering? I mean, was it just basic observation?
I think you're giving me too much credit for some of the research, especially medical research, which really was just talking to a couple of friends who are physicians who were working during the pandemic. I have one close friend who I really admire, although she refuses to be called a hero, but she told me a story once about in the height of the pandemic in April of 2020, being in the hospital and coming home and her husband's asking her about her day. And she said, I did one useful thing today. And this is a woman who's trained as an infectious disease specialist. So she was really, you know, she was the doctor that everyone needed. And she said, what I did was I found a charger for someone's iPad so they could FaceTime with their family. And, you know, that kind of helplessness that caregivers felt at a time, you know, especially doctors like Stephen in the book. You know, Stephen is somebody who's privileged, he's smart, he's hardworking. He hasn't come across a lot of situations where he was out of control. And this is the first time that he's feeling that. And he's kind of, he's at sort of a total loss. And I think that that was true for domestic caregivers as well. It was true for all of us as we tried to maintain some kind of normalcy for the people, you know, in our care, however old they were.
I'm going to read a quote from one of Pia's chapters. And Pia is the teenage daughter of Natalie and Stephen. And she's buying a gift for her future half-sibling. And it was really that store where there weren't any impatient parents or whining kids, where everyone was calm and happy because they were buying something for someone who didn't even exist yet, who was perfect. And I thought, since I wouldn't be here, I wouldn't exist either. And so to the baby, I would be perfect too. And while there are times Pia could be considered a spoiled teen, she was going through her own struggles, including cutting. Are there challenges you face as an author writing about the challenges of your characters?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's always a challenge to write from someone else's perspective. And I have a lot of rules for myself about what, you know, what I can do and what I can't do. But, you know, with Pia, she wasn't a narrator of the novel at first. That's the biggest change kind of that happened in the editing process, was that I thought she was, you know, I wasn't as interested in her at the beginning. And I knew she was a young person who was really angry at both of her parents. And it wasn't until I sort of hit on this idea of a journal for her that her perspective became more important, because it was a way to talk about, you know, she's angry about her mother's, about the kind of colonial legacy of France in Polynesia. She's really influenced by this young man who she meets, who is a Tahitian man who's employed at the lab, but has some ambivalence about what the scientists are doing there. And I thought, you know, this she writes mostly in lists, sometimes in dialogue. She's a budding actor, so she likes to write almost as if she were writing a play. And those lists were useful to me because some of the things that I learned about, especially about United States nuclear testing and French nuclear testing in the Pacific, were so unbelievable. I knew so little, I'd learned so little about it, that you know, a list of dates and tests was the way for where I thought the facts just staring at you with no editorializing was more powerful than if I had tried to write, you know, her thoughts about this kind of tragedy. So she was useful for me in that way. And she was fun because, you know, teenagers are angry and their anger gets displaced kind of all into all different containers, if that makes sense.
Well, what struck me about this book was how skillfully you captured the voices of each of the primary characters. And we learned the story through five characters, if I'm counting right.
Right.
And just as you would include lists for Pia, you know, there were often emails between Stephen and Natalie. How do you decide on perspective, which perspective is best for each of your characters, or point of view, or I always get those confused.
Yeah, no, for sure. You mean sort of who's telling this? Who? How
Who's
do I decide who's going to tell the story?
telling the story and how it's best told?
To write a story in the third person omniscient, but a limited omniscient where different characters tell the story. And I find that part of it to be very organic. I started with Kate, and then I went back. Once I had spoken to some scientists, I went back and wrote. I knew that the first chapter was going to take place underwater. The book begins underwater, and this, you know, the sun is coming up, and so the divers are seeing the reef kind of change from its black and white to color, basically. And I needed a little bit of extra information to write that scene, but I knew it was first. And then I moved to this luxury apartment in Manhattan, and Kate is newly married to Stephen, who's a physician who's older than she is and who has money. And so she's living in this, you know, in a way, the world is falling apart around her, and suddenly her circumstances are very different. You know, she's a teacher, she teaches a public school in Brooklyn. She wasn't destitute, but her situation was nothing like it is once she gets married. And she's kind of standing in the quiet. I think one of the things that's notable when you go into a, you know, a fancy residence is often how quiet it is. And she feels protected, but also like a little bit uneasy in her new circumstances. And I found that after that, the character, you know, sort of which chapter was coming next, it sort of, I don't like the idea of like a mystical power guiding you when you're writing. I don't really believe in inspiration exactly. Like for me, it's much more learning something is what makes me want to write. But in terms of who's next and which part of the story they're telling, that seemed to happen kind of organically once I knew who the people were. And I remember the day that I sat down and wrote about Athena, who's the young woman taking care of her nephew. And it's a really hot day, which, you know, summer people who spent summers in New York know what it's like. And she's walking to the laundromat with a bag of laundry over her shoulder, and her nephew, who insists on wearing a Spider-Man costume that has long sleeves and long pants, and she's worried that he's overheating, and she's worried that she forgot her money at home, and she's got this bag of laundry. And then they pass a newsstand, and there's this tabloid story about a pedophile, and she's just got a lot of worries on her plate for a 17-year-old girl. And so her story kind of came out of that moment. It always starts with something pretty concrete for me.
Several of your books feature characters from various parts of the world, whether it's a bride from Bangladesh or a Chinese performance artist in Los Angeles, you know, Southeast Asia, French Polynesia. There's a quote from one of Natalie's chapters. She had always thought that Americans wrote the best children's books because they were like children themselves. And I smiled when I read this, but it also made me wonder about assuming a critical lens. Is it difficult to view Americans through the eyes of some of your characters?
I think that when I first started writing stories, you know, I wrote a story and it was published, and then I sold the book. And the idea, you know, you need to tell people what your book's going to be about, and it's harder when it's a book of stories. And so I said, these are stories that take place in India and Southeast Asia, where I've spent the last, you know, couple of years. And everyone said, great, we're signing up for that. And what I realized when I was writing the book, that it was certainly not about those places in any more than this book is about French Polynesia. I'm not, you know, equipped to write a book about Oceania, but it's about the way that like we see ourselves almost in relief when we are in another place, and the maybe the absurdities and the sometimes hypocrisy, the contradictions of your own place just stand out in a way when you're somewhere else. So that really is why I think that that happens kind of again and again in book after book. I think my last book, Lost and Wanted, really, I didn't go anywhere. And, you know, since I've had children, it's a lot harder to go and spend, you know, a long period of time somewhere. In that book, and to some extent in this book, the science is like a foreign country, right? It's like a place that I can visit just by reading. And it was totally different for me because I didn't study science in any serious way in college.
Earlier, you mentioned working with high school students, helping them write college essays, and you acknowledged a school in your acknowledgments in the book. Can you talk to me about that program or what you do with them?
Sure. I love this program, and I would encourage anyone who is in New York City and is a writer to be part of it. It's called Penn Writers in the Schools, and I think there's probably corresponding programs all over the country, but it's a program where you go into a high school, and we and at our school we have been there for at this particular school for 7 years, and in the fall we do college essays. So we start with a personal narrative and the students work on that. They write one or two, and then they select one to become sort of the first draft of their college essay. And that's my favorite part of the year. We write more analytic essays in the spring, and those are fine, but the personal essay is my favorite because it's the first time that a lot of people are telling, you know, their most important story. It's the first time that they're writing it down. I sometimes say to them, you know, like, imagine you just made a new friend who you're crazy about and you guys are hanging out. And like, what's the story from your life that you would most want to tell? And that often leads us to something really exciting. You know, I think teenagers are, I think they're natural writers because they have access to this whole realm of experience that, you know, as adult writers, we're not familiar with. And they're really unfiltered. And there's a lot that is beautiful about, you know, putting something important to you down for the first time.
We have talked about a lot. Is there anything that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked?
That's a great question. Well, I guess, you know, I guess that one of the things that I learned from this book, I read two incredible books about the deep ocean at the beginning of my research. One is called The Brilliant Abyss by Helen Scales. It's wonderful if you're a marine biologist and your name happens to be Scales. And then the other one is by a woman named Edith Witter, who's another biologist who studies bioluminescence in the deep ocean. I really recommend both. That one's called Below the Edge of Darkness. But I didn't even know this was going to be part of the book, and it does end up being part of it because Natalie is really opposed to the idea of deep sea mining, which is something that's just starting to happen now as companies try to get the minerals that we supposedly need for batteries for electric vehicles. And of course, this is like a huge profit. This is a new industry that people are excited to profit from. And so for me, what was so exciting about learning about the deep ocean was, as a kid, I mean, I'm sure you're a big reader as a kid, I love the idea that there was another world that you could walk into, you know, that there's a world that's not evident to anyone around you. That's it's a very Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe kind of feeling. And when I started reading about the deep ocean, I thought, oh my God, there is a place like this. And not only that, like, I'm sure a lot of us have like a climate fantasy that we could just go back like a certain number of years and do things differently. And the deep ocean is a place where that's possible because it's so deep and it's so cold and so inaccessible. We haven't screwed it up yet. It's like an Amazon rainforest with comparable biodiversity down there that really we haven't touched. And so that was one of the things that was exciting in this book, was the idea that, you know, there was possibility. And because the book is so much about caregiving, it's like a hopeful story that you could tell young people, this is a place that we could still protect.
That was Nell Freudenberger, author of the book The Limits, which was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning. And our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.